Good morning, everyone. So far in class, we've sort of taken this perspective of, we can think of the Einstein equations as, you have some four-dimensional space-time manifold M, you have some metric defined on this four-dimensional space-time manifold, and maybe some matter on it too. And the Einstein equations basically just give you a relationship between these two quantities for a physical system. Now they just say, okay, there's some curvature tensor you can calculate for the metric, and it better obey the Einstein equations. But these equations don't refer to, explicitly to space or time, and they don't give you any sort of evolution. Really we're, used to thinking of, for example, in Newtonian mechanics or something like that, you say have a particle starts its position, I give it some velocity, what's its trajectory going to be? Or for the Maxwell equations, we say I have this, this electric field, these magnetic fields, how will they evolve in time, how will they propagate? Though actually, we can think of the Maxwell equations as having some evolution equations and some constraint equations, and we'll talk about how we can think of the Einstein equations in the same way. So sort of for the next two lectures, we're going to talk about how we can explicitly introduce the concept of time. And so today we'll talk about how we can take a four-dimensional space-time manifold and divide it, basically slice it into slices of time and define curvatures both that are intrinsic to those time slices and then also extrinsic that determine the curvature of those slices of time embedded in the four-dimensional manifold. And then tomorrow we'll talk about how we can decompose the Einstein equations into this so-called 3+1 decomposition, so into space and time. Yeah, and so sort of two references you can use if you want to do some more reading. So one would be this chapter in Wald. This is a little bit terse. All the gory details in the calculations are given in this lecture note, which you can find in the archive. So our treatment will sort of be a little bit intermediate between these two in terms of the depth we'll go through everything. All right, so we're going to start with defining hypersurfaces of a space-time. Okay, so we have our four-dimensional manifold M. And we're going to imagine we have an embedding of some lower dimensional, in particular three-dimensional surface. All right, let's say we have a four-dimensional manifold, and then we have a three-dimensional manifold, which I'm going to call sigma hat. And then we want to embed sigma hat and M. And what I mean by that is that we have some function phi that gives us a map from sigma hat to M. And we want it to be one-to-one. And we want both phi and its inverse to be continuous. So if this mapping, if we have this mapping, then we'll call basically what phi maps sigma hat 2, sigma, we'll call that a hypersurface. So that's sort of an abstract definition, but a natural way to define a hypersurface in some manifold is to take what's called a level set. So that's where you have some scalar function f, and you basically define your hypersurface to be all the points in that manifold where that function takes a particular constant value, for example, 0.
Excuse me, can you?
Yep.
What's sigma and what's the difference between sigma and sigma hat? Like, we define sigma as to be the map of sigma hat.
Yeah, so basically, you're just imagining at this point, we're going to make this distinction that we'll sort of drop it a little bit later on. But yeah, so I'm just imagining I have some separate three dimensional manifold sigma hat, and I can map points in this, 2 points in that, given phi, and then all the points, and so the mapping, the points that go from here to M, I'm calling sigma. Yeah. So an example of a hypersurface would be a level set. For example, all the points are a manifold where some scalar function takes the value 0. And this is particularly convenient because if we have a level set, then we can immediately define the normal to sigma. And we've already mentioned this a couple times before. So all you have to do is take the gradient of our scalar, and that gives us a normal to sigma. And what this means is that if we take our normal and we take the, we dot it, we take with any vector in sigma, then we get 0.
Sorry, what did you mean by level set there? You said sigma colon x, you said any points in manifold M, the function f takes 0?
Yeah, so I just define some function. So I introduce some function and I say, defined on my whole manifold, and I say wherever this function is 0, that's my hypersurface.
Oh.
And so we can introduce a little terminology based on basically the character of the normal. So if our normal is time-like, then what would you say the hypersurface is?
Space-like,
yeah. And conversely, if the normal is space-like, we'll call this one time-like. And if the normal is null, then
null.
Yep.
To have a hypersurface, we need to reduce the dimension of manifold by one and saying that now I have a hypersurface in my manifold. And you're saying here that this f is doing something like that all the time?
And
how is it? I'm not exactly
Oh,
I can feel it, but I'm not exactly convinced that this gives us a hypersurface.
yeah. Right. You're saying if I, yeah, not all Fs will give us, like, you know, if it would just identically zero everywhere, it would give you the whole
It's
surface.
like a constraint on the problem, and that's not.
Yeah. Yeah, so this, so yeah, it has to basically, you know, map some three-dimensional surface there. So yeah, you're right that that puts some restrictions on what you can have for a level set. But for example, a very simple one would be, okay, take Minkowski space, and then my hypersurfaces are the surfaces of constant time, and then my level set function is just time equals zero.
So level set can actually be any constraint on the manifold that reduces the manifold into like d minus one dimensional hypersurface.
Yeah. Okay. So from, you know, so in general, you can have hypersurfaces of all these different types, but sort of from here on, we're going to restrict to this case where sigma is space-like. A lot of what I say will sort of carry over, but this is the particular case we're interested in to sort of you know, be able to specify initial data on some time and evolve from there. Right, so you know, we can choose coordinates that are sort of locally adapted to our you know, space-like hypersurface just by sort of making the obvious choice. We introduce some time coordinate and then let the space coordinates actually map directly to the xi coordinates on our three-dimensional manifold. So this would sort of be coordinates on M that are adapted to this hypersurface. And you can always do this at least locally. And then, you know, the embedding is, so it's basically just a level set, as we said, and then the embedding is very simple. All we have to do is take our coordinate on sigma hat and just, you know, basically add a zero in front. And that gives us our coordinate on M, right? And you know, since we have this level set definition of our hypersurface, we can define a unit normal by taking the gradient and then normalizing our vector. So you can just by definition or by construction, when you dot this with itself, you get minus one. And the reason I took a minus sign here is so that it'll be future pointing. So you know, with if you were just in flat space with upper indices, this would just give you, you know, just a one in the time component, so it'd be future pointing. So that's why this minus sign is here.
There partial derivatives, you use the covariant derivative for to define the normal.
Yeah, but we're acting now on our scalar function, right? This level set.
Yeah.
So what's the difference?
That's true for this case. Okay.
Yeah.
But like the definition is normally is it normally the partial derivative? Like
well, I mean it's the same thing on a scalar, right? So.
That's true. Okay. Sorry. Yeah. That is a scalar function there as well.
Since we know how to map, you know, points or basically curves rather on sigma hat to m, we know how to map vectors, which can just be defined as the tangents to these curves, and basically the same way. So if we have some vector vi defined in sigma hat, then again we just add a zero in the time component to map it to a vector on m.
Oh, this is minus one.
And this is technically called the push forward mapping. Was there a question? Forget. All right, and then we can do the same thing for one forms with downstairs indices. And in the case where basically we're going from one forms on M and mapping them back to sigma hat. And so my claim is that if you have some one form of this form, so time and then spatial components and these adapted coordinates, then that just maps to the one form with the same spatial components on sigma hat. And that's called the pullback. And we can basically see that we have to have this definition in order for us to have basically the same, so if we take the dot product of two, we can track two vectors in M, we should get the same thing, and then instead take the one form and vector and map them to sigma hat, and then take the contraction of that there, we should get the same answer in either case. And so we can check that that gives you this property. So if we imagine in sigma hat, we have some vector v. So we want to take vi contracted with, so we have vi on sigma hat. We'll map that to m. We'll get 0 vi. And then we're going to contract that with u. And so then we're going to get vi ui over here. So we better map this to ui over here to get the same answer. Any questions about that? You know, so far everything looks pretty simple, but you know, the one thing we need to be careful of is that you know, if you do the reverse, if you start with a vector with you know, upstairs indices in M, mapping it to sigma hat, is not so straightforward. So in general, this does not map to vi and sigma.
Sorry, I didn't quite understand what you did here. You had 0 vi, and but your indices are kind of all over the place. The UT and UI, T is
yep.
downstairs, I is upstairs.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry, that's. Thank you. Yeah, so we have one with upstairs instances, downstairs. We start with this defined in sigma hat. We know how to map that to M. We just add a zero. We take a general one form and M. We're contracting it with it. So we know when you contract this, we get this. We know we better. And then we know this one form has to contract to something, or sorry, has to map to something in sigma hat, such that when we take this, when you contract it with whatever it maps to, we get this. So therefore, it has to be just this.
Yeah, but the inverse mapping doesn't necessarily work if that the time component of VI is not zero. If it was like VT VI, the pullback doesn't give you the right answer for the inner product.
Right. So I'm imagining I'm starting with some VI defined here, and then I'm seeing what I know how to map it that here, right?
Yeah.
So I've defined basically this way, and then we're going to define one forms going this way, right?
Okay.
And then
you're defining one forms in M, but you're defining the vectors in sigma.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and then now I'm saying this. Okay. This is not true in general. Like we haven't yet worked out how to map a general vector in M back to sigma hat.
Sorry, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So even before we choose the coordinate, can we have a projection operator to do these mappings, essentially?
Yeah, that's where we're going right now.
I mean, so essentially, we don't need to choose the coordinates. In a very general case, we can do that, right? If I have a three manifold within four manifolds, and I know the matrix in the... I just need to know the level surface, right? To know how I'm embedding the trees. Then I can make the projection operator. Is that correct?
Yeah. So we're gonna introduce the projection operator now. Yeah.
So have we fixed our coordinates here? Are we talking t is time? Saying t is time or not yet?
Yeah. So this is true in these like adapted these coordinates that are adapted to the hypersurface. In general. I mean, you could do this in a more coordinate invariant way where you didn't choose those coordinates, but it'll make our life easier. Yep. Yeah, so we're going to return in a second to the right way to do this. But since we sort of already know how to do general one forms in M, we can generalize that to tensors that have multiple lower indices. So that means for the metric and M, the induced metric, which I'm going to call gamma ij on sigma, is really just take the spatial components of Gij in our adapted coordinates. All right, so now let's go back to this question. So for any vector M, we can decompose it into a part that's tangent to sigma and a part that's orthogonal to sigma. So we can do that this way, using our unit normal as was hinted at. So that's the part that points in the direction you know, of our normal to our surface, and then we have some other part left over. So this is tangent, and we can call this part here so I'm gonna call this we can write this whole thing in terms of this projection operator sigma, which I am defining as the following. So we can check that indeed, if we take the projection of any vector, we can take that if we project any vector and then we look at its component that's orthogonal to the surface, then if we just crunch through that. Oops. Then we just get zero. So that kind of justifies this calling this a projection operator. If we take any vector, project onto our surface, then it has no component that's orthogonal. So now we can use this to define this general mapping. And for vectors, and that's the VA goes to this, just taking our projection operator.
And A for these are normals to the manifold that each one.
Sorry, so
an A is the normal to the manifold at each point. Is that like, is that defined? It's defined locally or globally? And A and B.
Yeah, it's it's basically just this thing, right? So it's the the normal to our hypersurface. Because we just took the gradient of the level surface. So it points, you know, perpendicular.
So we should define it at each point separately. I mean, like projection operator at one point is different from projection operator.
Yeah, yeah.
Projection operator is
the right in the general, you know, curve case. Yep, yep. And then we can also use this projection operator to define the other thing we're missing, which is how to take a general one form defined on sigma. And this tells us, oops. There we go. This tells us how to take that to let's try that one more time. All right, to a general one form on M. So you know, we can, you know, we did for vectors and for one forms, and in general we can apply it to you know any tensor with you know any number of upper and lower indices. So in particular, let's see what happens if we apply it to this induced metric gamma ij, this is the induced metric on sigma. So So if we do that, using these definitions, and you can sort of crunch through the math, you'll get the following. And you can sort of check that this makes sense in the sense that, you know, if you take so if you have two vectors that you know live in sigma, so this and this equals zero, then contracting them either with this induced metric or with the full metric will give you the same thing because this part will cancel out.
Sorry.
Yeah.
What I don't understand this. You repeated the one thing twice.
Here?
Yeah.
This is a U and that is a V. So.
Oh.
Sorry if that was a little messy.
Oh, okay.
So two vectors, two arbitrary vectors u and v that have this property, that they have no component orthogonal to the surface. So if you have two of those, then you can take their, you can contract them with this guy or with this guy, and you get the same thing because of this, right? And if instead you have some different vector that sort of points in the direction of NA, then if you, maybe I should put the hat, it's tilde, then whenever you apply this, you'll just get zero. And you can, that just follows immediately from this. And you notice that I kind of, in an abuse of terminology, I, you know, introduced this projection operator, and I use gamma, and I also use gamma for the induced metric, but it's sort of justified by this, you know, where you can see that indeed, if I just take this and raise it with the metric, then I do just get that, right? So that's why we're using the same symbol.
The first two gammas, you have A index and I index, but they have different number of, like the last line, and when you're raising the gamma A, like gamma IA, is that a square matrix? Or gamma JB?
Sorry, which line are we looking at?
Like when you're raising the gamma AB, not the way, when you're low, okay, when you're pulling back the gamma IJ to the, when you use gamma IA, is that a square matrix?
Here?
Yeah, because I have like one less component than A, right?
So in general, it'll be like this, but we're just we're only letting these indices go over the spatial ones, because so far, we've only defined this.
Yeah, but like you just choose it. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
And now the claim is that this projection operator is the only global kind of fullback that we can have from our manifold to a hypersurface, or there can be other. Like, all we want is to reduce the dimension by one. And we can do this by using the normal to the manifold at each point. But are there also other ways to do this? Like we can just, any one-dimensional constraint can do this for us, right?
Yeah, I mean, so this is just saying, given some hypersurface, which for convenience we define in terms of this level set and this adapted coordinates, like given that, then we can basically define all this mapping between vectors on the hypersurface and vectors, you know, vectors and tensors in general on the hypersurface and the metric. So this is sort of the unique mapping that we want given this choice of hypersurface. But yeah, there are many different ways one can specify hypersurfaces.
But this map between a hypersurface to the manifold is unique. Like once we have the induced metric and our hypersurface, there is a unique way to go from the manifold to the hypersurface with that induced metric. That's what you're saying.
I think the answer is yes. I mean, I'm saying we started by choosing some hypersurface, and the hypersurface is defined by this embedding. And so once we make that choice, then it follows what the induced metric and so on will be. So we don't have choice about that. Yeah.
Oh, wait. What are you writing? When you say sigma and m, and you have the I and the arrow, gamma IA, the second column or the last, the middle column that you have written, the second row?
Sorry, here?
Yes,
yeah.
Second, third.
Yeah, that's doesn't look
right. Sandwich between the two lines.
No.
Yeah,
exactly. I just can't figure out the letters.
And A, B, B?
Yeah, I think that's...
A?
Yeah, I think that should all be contracted, right?
Yes, that's A. And what
else? Right, so that just gives you... Yeah, well, you write it this way. That's one term, and then this term here,
yes.
We contract. Yep. Yeah.
Just one more question. This is the way that we can embed some hypersurface that the induced metric and it is just.
Yeah, I think this minus sign came from contracting. Sorry, just to go back, this minus sign came contracting n with n. Yeah, but sorry, what's good?
I thought that was just okay. This gives us a way to go from like to embed a hypersurface that has an induced metric, which is just the original metric and the manifold, but only on the spatial part. Does it mean that we cannot embed any hypersurface that has another induced metric or? I mean, like, I can have a hypersurface that has, like, some very exotic metric on it. Can I embed any hypersurface into manifold, or? I mean, this...
I think you...
Yeah, I mean, it gives us a way, if we can do the time slicing this way, it gives us a way that if I have a hypersurface that the induced metric on it is just the special part of the metric and manifold, I can do the embedding using this. But if I have another...
Pullback is unique, but the push forward is not.
Huh?
Like the pullback form is unique. So once you have the embedding, when you pull back the metric onto the hypersurface, it will be unique.
But yeah, I mean, this is a special hypersurface. It's not any arbitrary
hypersurface. Why are you calling it a special hypersurface?
Because we have the induced metric.
Yeah, so
it's not any metric.
Time,
it's
right?
Some special. Yeah, it depends on our time slice.
So even n could be any normal here.
Yeah. So I mean, I think maybe your question is, I mean, once we choose this embedding, like I didn't tell you what the metric on sigma was, and so we just through having already a metric on M, right, we get this induced metric on sigma, right? But maybe you're saying
that what induced metric we're going to get on our hypersurface.
Yeah.
And we can choose any time, like we can get any induced metric by just choosing a proper time slicing.
I don't know about any induced metric, but yeah, I mean, so given so to go the time slicing case, given a four-dimensional manifold, There's definitely different choices on how to slice the time, slice it into slices of constant time, and you know, once you make that choice, you'll get a metric on each of those hypersurfaces. But different choices of how to do that slicing will give you different metrics, induced metrics on those hypersurfaces.
But
yes.
The induced metrics on the hypersurfaces is constrained by the original metric and the manifold. We cannot get any induced metric by, we cannot embed any hypersurface with any with any metric on it inside our manifold. That should be a constraint.
Right. Yeah. The metric. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, once you make the choice of the time slice, then you'll get
we cannot get any kind of metric on hypersurfaces by just choosing time slice, just choosing a good time slice.
I mean, definitely you can get different ones. I don't know if you can get sort of arbitrary ones. Yeah, I would guess no. Yeah.
I don't quite get what you're talking. Like, if I have any general manifold, I can just like define different metrics on it by just Gordon transformation.
When you have a manifold, you have the metric.
Yeah, but like the metric is arbitrary. I can redefine it by changing the coordinate to anything.
No, not like anything.
Think
anything.
Of this that this is true even if you
that's my problem maybe.
Yeah. So maybe we can come back to your question if you still have one. But we're going to talk about exactly the sort of curvature of sigma and how it's determined.
Yes.
So we can sort of distinguish between two types of curvature in sigma. So one is going to be sort of the intrinsic curvature that's just defined in terms of quantities on sigma. And then we'll also talk about the extrinsic curvature, which is basically the curvature of how sigma is embedded in M. So the intrinsic curvature is pretty simple. Basically, just have to generalize the usual definitions that we had for our four-dimensional quantities. So it's basically the same as all our quantities for GAB and M. But now with gamma ij and sigma. So we can introduce a covariant derivative in the usual way. Just by making it, you know, compatible now with gamma ij. And we're also assuming it's, you know, the usual thing that it's torsion free. And so this will be defined, you know, with now a three-dimensional Christoffel symbol. Which will just, you know, again, you know, will just be have the exact same definition as the four-dimensional case, but with, you know, derivatives of now gamma ij. And, you know, so on, we can introduce a three-dimensional Riemann tensor. Again, it'll basically tell us, you know, the extra term when you try to switch these covariant derivatives tied to some metric, or sorry, to some vector. And then, you know, again, we can have some three-dimensional Ricci scalar, Ricci tensor and Ricci scalar, just again by, you know, contracting our three-dimensional Riemann tensor and three-dimensional Ricci tensor. And you know, one can actually check that if we take the covariant derivative of some general tensor, then this is the same as if we basically took the four-dimensional covariant derivative and then did the projection. Yeah, so just saying, this is the same as if just take the covariant derivative and then do the projection, or take some tensor just defined in the n sigma and use this covariant derivative with this induced metric. And so we can just check this compatibility property. So if we take our covariant derivative of this metric, we should just get zero, right?
I'm sorry, I don't understand the dots there. What you have, gamma v1 a is d1, and then I think you're saying gamma b2 d2, gamma b3 d3, and then when you reach gamma E1, C1.
Yeah, sorry. That's right. So this would be continued with like a B2, D2, and so on. And this would be continued with a E2, C2, all the way for however many indices you have.
Oh, okay, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, and so we can check, so we should get zero here. So if we apply this general expression and try not to mess up the indices, so then I claim that's zero. So to see that, well, first of all, when we apply this to that, what do we get?
Zero
just by four-dimensional metric compatibility. And then if we apply this one to NAV, we're going to get we're going to get derivative of one of these and then just times another one. But then as soon as we contract this guy with any of these, we should get zero. That's why this is zero. So that's all the extrinsic curvature, but we now can talk about extrinsic curvature, and that's this measure of how sort of curved sigma is in M. And by the way, you might have noticed, but at some point I stopped drawing the hats. So we've taken off our hats. We're being a little bit informal here, and we're basically not trying to make any distinctions between this three-dimensional manifold and its embedding in the four-dimensional space-time from here on. We'll just treat them as the same thing.
Well, I think this isn't the first two gammas in the last equation, in the last sentence. The first two gammas in the right-hand side. EV and EC.
Sorry, this is not right, huh?
Well, are those D and E?
Yes. Thank you. What do I have? D, E. Thank you.
Can we also project down like the four-dimensional Riemann tensor with just the projection operator to find the three-dimensional one? Does this follow from the definition there? For to find the three-dimensional Riemann tensor, for example. Or do I need to construct it from the crystal samples in three dimensions?
Yeah. Actually, so that's we'll when we start to decompose the Einstein equations, we'll do that whole projection. But yeah, it's a little bit more complicated. Like basically, if you take the four-dimensional, Riemann tensor, it's going to have some components that are like these spatial components given by the spatial curvature, and then also have some components given by the extrinsic curvatures, which we'll introduce. Yeah. Yeah. So. That brings us to our next point, which is the extrinsic curvature. So the extrinsic curvature is sort of, roughly speaking, imagine you have some, this is sigma, it's embedded in like this. You take some vector, and then you, you take the normal at some point, and then you parallel transport it, and then you compare it with, the normal at some nearby point. So the extrinsic curvature basically is going to be a tensor that tells you the difference between these two. And we're going to define it as the following. And let's just start with an example where we consider a very simple example. We have a cylinder, so a two-dimensional surface that's embedded, in three-dimensional, Cartesian space-time. So this is a little bit different from, slices of constant time, but it'll be sort of a good illustration. So we'll just take the unit cylinder, which are all the points are in R3 that are given by x squared plus y squared equals 1. And I'll call that rho squared. So the you know, you can check for yourself that the intrinsic curvature of the cylinder vanishes. You know, if you're just stuck to the surface of the cylinder, it looks flat to you. However, the extrinsic curvature, not all these components are zero. You know, and in particular, you know, if in the phi direction, you know, as you go around in the phi direction, your unit normal will sort of change directions, and that'll be embedded in the extrinsic curvature. So we can calculate that. So first we need the unit normal. So, you know, I have this level set definition of our cylinder, so that makes it easy to calculate this. And then we can then calculate these derivatives. In R3, so just flat spacetime of this unit normal. And with just a little bit of algebra, we get this in Cartesian coordinates. And you'll notice, in particular, the extrinsic curvature is a symmetric tensor, right? So, you know, this entry and this entry are the same, and so on for these. Right. So now we just want to take this this quantity, add a minus sign, and then project it onto our surface. So basically write it in terms of the coordinates defining our cylinder, which are phi and z, with tangent of phi equal to y over x. Basically, to put these into these the cylindrical coordinates, you know, we just need to calculate the Jacobian of this transformation. Oops. So, basically, if we apply the Jacobian to that, so you can crunch through that if you want on your own, but my claim is the sort of one non-zero component is going to be the phi phi component, and we get that, and we said that we're taking the unit cylinder, so we just get minus one. So that basically, you know, tells you how curved this cylinder is, and you know that makes sense. This is basically the radius of our cylinder. So just as we defined, or just as we took this three-dimensional that were the induced metric, and then defined on a whole space-time manifold using the projection operator, we can do this the same thing for the extrinsic curvature. And you know, if you use our definition of that, which is all the way up there, and sort of crunch through that, my claim is you'll get this, which makes sense, but then you also get one extra component. And this is sometimes called the, it's called, sometimes people just call it A, because it's the quote unquote acceleration vector. Because you can think of this NA as a, you know, the velocity of the observer that sort of, moving orthogonal to our slices of constant time. Yeah, so I guess we're out of time here, but tomorrow or Thursday we'll sort of give a different way to think about this extrinsic curvature as actually measuring how the, right here we just talked about a single slice of time, but next we'll talk about how to take a space-time manifold and divide up into a series of slices of time, and then we'll talk about how we can think about this extrinsic curvature tensor is basically telling us how the induced metric changes or evolves from one time slice to the next. But for that, we'll need this idea of a foliation. So let me stop there and ask if there are any questions.
I think I find a way to maybe phrase that question better, but I feel that it would be answered by this extrinsic curvature. But like, for example, you cannot embed any kind of hypersurface without singularity in a manifold that has a singularity, a true singularity. But like,
probably a similar. And it's probably the correct way to somehow constrain this embedding is through extrinsic curvature. So let me make sure I understand your question. So you're saying, imagine I have a manifold. It has some points on the manifold. Are singular, and the curvature blows up for those points. Can I make a hypersurface that contains those points where the singularity is, and not have a singularity? Is that your question?
Is it? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think you. Yeah, I mean, maybe it'll become a little more clear when we sort of decompose the Riemann tensor. But yeah, I think you probably have some choice whether, so for example, if your curvature is blowing up, I think depending on how you choose that hypersurface, you'd have some choice of whether that blow up in the space-time curvature was manifested in a blow up in the extrinsic curvature or the intrinsic curvature, but probably you couldn't get away with having both of them be non-singular, because they're sort of combined together to give you the full space-time curvature. If that makes sense.
Curvature of our original manifold, both extrinsic and intrinsic, it would constrain on what hypersurfaces with what intrinsic and extrinsic curvature we can embed inside.
Yeah, or in some sense once you choose a hypersurface, then some part of the four-dimensional curvature is manifested in the intrinsic one, and another part is in the extrinsic one, and sort of what goes into what is depends on the choice of hypersurface, just in the same way that what we call space and what we call time that can change a little bit depending on how you choose your coordinates.
Sweet.
Yeah, so maybe like go ahead and end here, but I'm happy to stick around and answer any other questions there might be.